ABC News Radio, I'm Tom Graham. An FBI agent has gone missing in Southern California. More than 100 Los Angeles deputies and agents are now searching a rugged mountain area for Stephen Ivins. The missing agent is said to be suicidal and is believed to have a handgun with him. With graduation approaching, a time for celebration turned somber at Boston University as students learned of their three classmates killed in a minivan crash while studying in New Zealand. Kevin Taylor of the New Zealand Police says they're still investigating the accident.
You can see some scrape marks where the vehicle has left the road, veered left into the gravel. We're not sure why that's happened, and that will be a focus of the inquiry.
Boston University held a candlelight vigil last night for those killed. Slumping state tax revenue has caused California's projected $9 billion budget deficit to balloon to $16 billion. An announcement made by Governor Jerry Brown. This is NBC News Radio. There's been an impromptu and unauthorized protest in Moscow led by prominent Russian novelists and poets trying to assert their right to assemble without official permission. Around 10,000 people have gathered. New research predicts Japan will have no children under the age of 15 in 1,000 years. NBC's Scott Carr has more.
Maybe it's a stretch, but according to researchers at a Sendai School of Economics, if current trends were to continue, Japan would have absolutely no children under the age of 15 in 999 years. Professor Hiroshi Yoshida, an expert on the economics of aging, has developed a population clock that predicts the child population count at any given moment in time. His main reason for making the clock was to get people to think about Japan's falling birth rate. Perhaps more alarming is that Yoshida says the overall trend is toward extinction, which started in 1975 when Japan's fertility rate fell below 2 children per woman. Scott Carr, NBC News Radio.
More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Tom Graham, NBC News Radio.
On my journey to help save people money on car insurance, people have been really surprised to learn that GEICO can also help with renter's insurance. They're even more surprised when I tell them it costs as little as $12 a month. But perhaps what's most surprising is that I still live with my mum. Yeah, I know, I really should start thinking about renting my own place. But then I'd have to get my own tea kettle, sofa, shower curtain, soap dish.
Visit GEICO.com to see how affordable renter's insurance can be.
Now you can dial a diamond and save half by calling Empire Diamond at 1-800-SAVE-HALF. Over 70 years in the Empire State Building, they'll sell diamonds wholesale without a middleman's markup. That's right, GIA-graded diamonds at half the price of famous high-end jewelers. Qualified buyers may have diamonds into their home or office for a free 10-day no-obligation inspection and get a 60-day money-back guarantee. So save half on your diamonds. Visit at dialadiamond.com or call 1-800-SAVE-HALF. That's 1-800-SAVE-HALF.
Adobe Acrobat Pro is actually used very commonly for PDF archiving. If you've got a lot of files of different formats and different types, if you just save these files into all these different formats, then 20 years later somebody wants to look at the file, they'd actually have to have the program that could open up that file. So for digital archiving, you'd rather have a standardized file format.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Here at Best Buy, we have expanded our selection of HD Radio car stereo receivers. New HD Radio car stereos are in store and offer you the best in digital entertainment and information. More music from local HD2, HD3 radio stations, iPhone, iPod control, digital traffic, iTunes tagging, and more. Best Buy has the leading brands, Alpine, Pioneer, Kenwood, JVC. Lots to choose from, with prices as low as $120. Here at Best Buy, we recommend HD Radio technology.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on 1500 AM at 10 AM. Join me this week for my special guest, Mike Baker of the Baker Parekh Group at Morgan Stanley. He'll talk about his special retirement planning tools. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax. If you'd like to know more about the firm, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. And we have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, including Judy Marks, who's the president and CEO of Siemens Government Technologies, Niles Krona, who is the COO of Conservation International, Andrew Watt, the president and CEO of Association of Fundraising Professionals, and Stephen Martin, the co-founder and managing partner of Pace Harmon. Joining us first is a young lady by the name of Judy Marks, who's the president and CEO of Siemens Government Technologies. What is Siemens Government Technologies, Judy?
Peter, we are a federally compliant company that represents all of Siemens' products and services offerings. We're a large conglomerate of Siemens. We have offerings in healthcare, infrastructure, and energy, and industrial solutions across the world. And I have a privilege of running the part of the company that offers those solutions to our federal customers.
So give us an example specifically of what type of products. I know Siemens is a large company that's into a lot of things.
We are. We go from light bulbs to locomotives on any given day, but we're also the largest water technology provider in the world. We have a tremendous array of renewable energy technologies, wind, solar, and yet in healthcare, we do imaging technology, diagnostic solutions. So our goal is, again, to improve energy efficiency and really make people live in a better environment, sustainable environment.
Is that the primary focus of this particular group, is energy efficiency and a better environment?
You know, we actually have the ability to bring everything Siemens develops in 190 countries, and it gets manufactured in lots of places, including right here in the United States. We have 60,000 employees here in the U.S., and we believe we have the answers to some of our nation's problems.
When did this particular unit get started?
Well, Siemens has been in the business 165 years almost, when you go back to its German roots. The organization here is almost a year old. Again, a new part of the organization, although we've been doing business in the federal government for a long time, we've been doing it locally. And our responsibility is really now to step up that game, to grow that business and accelerate it.
When did you become the president and CEO?
This company was actually formed October 1st. I joined Siemens a little earlier than that to actually form it, to put together the governance structure. We have our own board of directors, as well as to figure out how best to align within such a large corporation.
So this is your baby.
I feel responsible.
There you go. Why are you, or were you, the ideal pick to do this? What made you the one that could do this better than anybody else?
I think I bring a unique blend of skills. First and foremost, I'm an engineer by degree. So I've spent my career in the technology field. I started with IBM Federal Systems, acquired a few times, became part of the Lockheed Martin Corporation. So I've always been in large enterprises. So I try and figure out how to optimize both people and enterprises to optimize and enter new markets.
So is it safe to say or accurate to say that you do startups inside of big corporations?
I do startups and try to grow businesses inside very large businesses.
That sounds a little unusual. What? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, every company has its own DNA and its own culture, and every company started as a small business and had to identify the markets it wanted to serve, what was its core competencies, very basic things I think everyone really understands and learns. Trying to do that when you're already a very large going concern and figure out where the gaps are and where you can optimize the people. And I mean, I'm in a company that's been innovating for, you know, over 100 years. So if I can take that innovation with brilliant people, motivate them, lead them, and serve a customer that I've spent almost 28 years serving the federal government, to me, that's the perfect alignment.
I've done a few startups, and I would say they're characterized by this ability to be agile and nimble and resource thin. How can you do that in large companies that are more characterized by stable and conservative and
process-laden?
Yeah.
I think that's where the challenge comes in, and that's where you need that agility. You need to motivate the workforce to just figure out when to push and how far to push. But think about the resources of a $100 billion company that I have. Think about that ability to have available products and services off the shelf.
Well, I mean, that could be just another VC that you're trying to get money out of. How do you convince somebody to let go of some of that $100 million resource?
I call it friend raising.
Friend raising?
Friend raising. And if you don't think you do that in every job you're in, then you're missing something. You need allies. You need people that all are focused on common objectives. And you got to revel in the successes. And, you know, it's easier to have a higher CAGR when you're small. The challenge comes when you become far more stable.
So you started your professional career as an engineer.
Yeah.
Why engineering?
I always loved math and science. I excelled at it. And just someone recommended in high school the next step would be engineering. Followed that passion, went to Lehigh University, and as I left there, became a systems engineer with IBM and learned how to solve problems.
Where did the entrepreneurial itch come from?
Probably from the family. My father ran a small business, and we were raised with that business. He ended up working and then eventually co-owning a department store in suburban Philadelphia. And we were raised with that. Every night he'd come home and we'd have discussions around the table on how the business did that
day. I know. You tell a great story about dinner conversations. Why don't you tell us?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting when you're a family business and a small business because every day does matter and every customer does matter. But my father, who's no longer with us, would come home and he'd have a small deck of cards in his jacket pocket. And on that deck, handwritten, line by line, was each department and how they had done same day sales, the store last year versus this year. And that the big question at the dinner table was, did we make the day? And so what you learn is you learn the interesting nuances of seasonality. You remember when the snowstorm was a year before. But I think what you also learn is accountability and how that translates to the family.
So you must have been pretty young when some of these dinner conversations were going on, right?
Absolutely.
What was it like? What were you excited to hear it? What was going on for
well,
you
a little
listening
bit of anticipation.
To this stuff?
I mean, I think it's like all of us who are involved in public corporations, right? Quarter points are fascinating times. We just had it on a daily basis.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's where, you know, this whole mix of how do you lead strategically versus tactically comes into play. And that was really tactical.
Tell us what you were like as a kid.
I was studious. I was very competitive. Played a lot of sports. Always loved being with other people. I was the youngest of three children. I have some great siblings. We all follow different paths. And I would tell you, I never expected this path. I don't believe you figure out at that stage in your life. You want to lead and you want to develop other people and you want to, you know, obviously make a difference.
So did you work in your father's business?
We all did. Every one of us at the holidays, during the summers, after school.
What did that experience teach you?
It taught me everything you can imagine about customer service. And, you know, I've worked for very large enterprises in my career. I started again with IBM Federal, then had a fantastic career with Lockheed Martin, a great company, and now I'm with one of the largest conglomerates globally at Siemens. It's still all about people doing business with people, and it's about servicing the customer no matter how large they are, no matter how transparent they are, like our government. But at the end of the day, people want to know they can count on you and you're going to be there.
So you sound like you would have made a great retailer. Why not just do that?
I think as a kid, the last thing you want to do is what your parents do. And we saw that he had a tremendous work ethic. That was required in retail.
Sure.
It was required. It's required in everything we do. So I think I learned the work ethic there. But for some reason, I thought it might be different if I, you know, was part of a larger business enterprise, and the answer is it isn't. We all work hard every day, and it doesn't stop even at my level. I mean, we work long days.
Yeah. What do you most like about your current role?
It's a fewfold. One is, I think, the challenge. As I said, I really spent 27 years in my career with really the same enterprise, even though it had different names and we went through acquisitions. But at the end of the day, I knew everyone there. I was comfortable, and they gave me tremendous opportunity, and I had the ability to perform and be successful. About a year ago, I said, I want to see if I could transition my leadership skills to an enterprise where I know no one. And that's what I did. So now, not only am I doing what I have a passion for, which is growing businesses inside large enterprises, I get to do it in a very global corporation, which we truly are, and I get to do it and see if my skills are up to speed.
Tell me about the first time you were in a leadership position.
I entered leadership very young, about 3 years out of school. IBM gave me the opportunity to be a manager of the department that I actually had worked in, which is a fascinating challenge for a very young engineer now to transition and do through others, learn how to delegate. And everyone in that department was clearly more senior to me and older than me at the time, I think I can say that. And so you had to motivate a workforce where you used to be the junior employee. And that was an interesting challenge.
Oh, tell me about that. I mean, how did you do it?
Well, I went to the most senior and experienced ones, and I said, I solicited their help. I asked them to give me guidance, to give me mentoring, to share with me where they had run into issues in their careers, what to avoid, and I asked them for advice. What would you do if you were in this position?
If I was interviewing your father, would he be surprised in how his daughter turned out?
I don't know. Sorry, a little emotional. I don't know. He's been gone for 25 years now.
Yeah. But what would you like to say to him?
I hope I made him proud.
Yeah.
I hope I made him proud, and I hope I'm making a difference in the lives of my daughter, who's an engineering student, and in the lives of a lot of young people right now.
Yeah. How about your proudest moment up till now, Judy?
I think the proudest moment was when I was able to truly motivate and develop other people to deliver a time kind of mission critical solution for a government customer, and I've got more than a few of those that I look back at wonderfully.
And the website address?
Website www.siemensg, so it's SIEMENSGOVT.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Judy Marks, who's the president and CEO of Siemens Government Technologies. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Rick Palmer.
Rick, who are you with?
I'm the Vice President of Business Development with Integrity Management Consulting.
What is Integrity Management Consulting?
Integrity is a rapidly growing small business here in McLean, and we're proud to be ranked as one of the top fastest growing companies in the local area and in the state of Virginia.
What kind of work do you do, in just a few words?
We do acquisition planning and program management support.
For the federal government?
For the federal government.
Okay. Now, you're not here really to talk too much about what Integrity does. You're here to do some celebrating. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
What are you celebrating?
Well, we've just been named one of Virginia's fantastic 50 companies for 2012. We're one of the fastest growing companies in the state of Virginia, and we're going to be receiving that award very shortly.
Tonight?
Yes.
Fantastic. You're also one of the seven precious jewels?
Yes, we were just named one of Consulting Magazine's seven small jewels for 2012 as one of the fastest growing companies in the area.
But we're not done yet, are we?
No, absolutely not.
There was one more thing you were going to celebrate.
We have a good nationwide presence, and particularly in the southwestern United States. We've just opened a field office in Fort Worth, Texas, where a lot of our business is.
You're able to accomplish all these things because you're able to focus and compete effectively in a full and open environment. How are you able to do that, in a few words?
Well, how we're able to do that is just the fact that we evolved our company very, very quickly. The founders and the owners did that, and quite honestly, we just did not attempt to do all things all at the same time, focused on some great areas, and built the business where we could.
We've been speaking with Rick Palmer of Integrity Management Consulting, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. And it is my pleasure to introduce you to Niels Krona, who is the COO of an organization called Conservation International. What is Conservation International, Niels?
Conservation International is a, as it says, a conservation organization, but it has a particular slant in it. Really tries to connect the natural habitat to economic development and say they're actually dependent on each other. and trying to work on demonstrating that around the globe.
And give us an example of a project that we might recognize.
We just started a great effort in Tanzania, working with the Gates Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they're very interested in improving the livelihoods of smallholder farmers to make sure they can grow more food on their land, of course. And they have come in with a lot of good solutions to that. What they had not really thought about was the sustainability of that food production. So if you cut away the habitat around it and don't get the water, that would actually be devastating over time. So what we are doing with them now is actually monitoring these flows to make sure that they continue to kind of feed the food production.
So it is this interdependence or relationship between technology and the environment, and that's what you guys are doing?
That is what we're doing, and a very big focus on demonstrating, because it's great to talk about in the abstract, but we try to really get on the ground or in the water to proof of concept.
How old is the organization?
It's 25 years old this year. It was a spin-off from the Nature Conservancy, another great conservation organization, and was founded by Peter Seligman at the time, and he's still our CEO, mm-hmm. so he's been around for now 25 years.
How big or small are you today?
We are about 1,000 people in 30 countries around the globe, and our budget is $150 million plus minus.
Uh-huh. And how do you get your funds?
It's all fundraising. We don't have big endowments. We don't have a huge membership either, so it's really fundraising with individuals, foundations.
Wow. When did you join the organization?
I joined it 9 years ago. I actually joined as the CFO at the time, and then kind of got into the CEO role about 4 years ago.
Why join the company?
I'd worked at the Nature Conservancy back in time, so knew a bit about the area of conservation. And when a small startup that I helped found ran out of cash, unfortunately, I was looking around for what I want to do next. And I thought my background in private industry could actually help a conservation organization become more effective. And
did that turn out to be the case?
I think we had made a lot of headway, and I also met Peter Seligman, who's a wonderful visionary leader, and I often kind of attach myself to such people because you learn a lot.
Uh-huh. Say a little bit more about that.
I think one thing, if you looked at my resume, I've been kind of in private industry various places. I've been in nonprofits various places, and I think the common thread through it is people, leadership, mentors. I've always been interested in kind of working with people I could learn from, work for great leaders, and I've had those relationships now 4 or 5 times. So a lot of my career choices actually also been based on the people I work with and can learn from.
You tell a very poignant story in the green room about a significant event about when you were 10 years old. Tell us a little bit about that.
My parents were divorced when I turned 10 years old, and it was actually unusual at the time, that many years ago, not so much today, but my father left the family and I didn't see him for 20 years after that, so I was there alone with my mother and my two siblings.
And you were looking for male role models or ways to be man?
Yeah, I don't think it was deliberately, but when I think back about it, it has been a pattern that I've been looking to male role models. And learn from them and follow them like many kids, of course, do with their dads. So I'm sure there's some connection there.
Yeah. What was it like, and you're from Denmark, what was it like growing up in Denmark?
Denmark is a wonderful, we call it hyggelig, but it's kind of nice and cozy country, but not a hugely dynamic country. One of the interesting things when I go back to Denmark, all my former high school friends live within 10 miles of where they grew up. So it's a very stable society. People work the same place, have the same friends for years.
You chose a different path, though. You decided you wanted to get out of Denmark.
Yeah, and I think when I was thinking about what to do next, I knew that an MBA from the U.S. would be a great stepping stone to something bigger and better, so that's why I picked to come to the States and went to UCLA to get my MBA from 83 to 85, and I think that opened a lot of doors, and I loved the the U.S. flexibility. Kind of, as I said, I've had a wonderful career where I've learned so much from being in various positions, various places. We lived in New York, we lived in L.A., we lived in Chicago, we lived in Washington.
What's the difference between the United States and Denmark?
I think the risk-taking is higher probably in this country, which means you are willing to leave a job even though you are kind of on a nice career path, which I was in Denmark actually, to a nice organization you could have stayed in and retired from 40 years later, and many people pick that. I think I like the little riskier path of trying new things, jumping to new organization, jumping to new challenges.
So what is it that made you so different from all your friends growing up, that you're the risk taker? What do you attribute that to?
I don't know. I think part of it is the people side that I learned from my mother, who is, or was, is now deceased, a fantastically personal individual who built bonds through personal relationships. So I think I got very outgoing based on that, and willing to talk to new people, learn from new things, and I think she showed me the way to do that. So that might be one reason for it.
Yeah. You've had the great fortune of having some really great mentors along the way. Mm-hmm. And early, you were telling us in the green room that the way that you relate to them is a little different than I've heard before. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, as I said, I really enjoy working with people I can learn from. But I figured out, both for them and some of the CEO clients I work with in my consulting life, that you need to work with them as a peer, not as a subordinate. You really need to say, I'm here, I can add value to a discussion. And I actually seen the reaction from mentors who have been years older than me saying, wow, you have some ideas that I didn't have. So you can actually be more of an equal partner in the relationship. Me learning, but maybe they learning from me too. And
right.
I feel like that has been very successful and kept those relationships vibrant.
Yeah, we hear this a lot on the show about the value of a mentor. Mm-hmm. What do you think the mentors along the way saw in you that wanted them to give their time and attention to you?
I think it was my willingness to try new things and always have the perspective that there is a solution. If we all put our brains together to most things. So willingness to actually learn and willingness to solve problems and willingness to push back on them and letting them know that I had some ideas that might be useful.
Yeah. What would you like to accomplish at the Conservation International?
What I'd like to accomplish as the institution, conservation organization, I would love to see 5-10 years from now heads of states, corporate leaders, really understanding this connection between the natural habitat and economic development, so we get smart of managing our own resources on this globe and really see that taking care of the natural habitat actually is a benefit. So if you see heads of states, if you see business leaders getting to that, or the Gates Foundation, they have great relationship with them now, and they're beginning to kind of think about their work in terms that we are putting on the table too.
Talk to us about the importance of impact to you.
I think that is ultimately how I judge myself, is can I change something? Can I make a positive difference? And I think it's whether it's in the private industry making things slightly more efficient, or as a nonprofit really achieving some of the things I talked about, having the heads of state. We went to Colombia and we met the president of Colombia recently, who listened to us and actually absorbed a lot of it and had some ideas about what he wanted to do next based on that. So that kind of dialogue with important, influential people and change the way they think about problems, I think, is my changing people's perspective, I think, is my impact.
Is there a moment in time when you realized that, going back, that impact would be the driver for you, how you would judge yourself?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it's somewhat connected with my arrival in this country, actually, getting to the business school, which is very different than any university experience I had in Denmark, was really impact-oriented, was made business impact-oriented, and I realized that that's what we're ultimately about. If you can impact something in a positive way, that's your legacy. And impact comes through people 90% of the time.
Right. What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
I think it was actually when my parents got divorced as a 10-year-old, not having a father figure, and suddenly with my mother going back to work. She was a dentist, working late hours, and I was the one taking care of my two siblings, cooking dinners at 10 years old, and almost being the dad in the family.
Right.
Which, it's hard when you're 10, I guess, but you learn something from it.
Yeah. What'd you learn?
Again, I think I learned that I could do it. I'm 10 years old, and many would say, wow, you can't do that, but it worked.
Yeah.
I succeeded in making it happen.
Yeah. How about your proudest moment?
What's the proudest moment? I think the... it's my kids. My daughter now, I was just at her high school today when she got a Pride Award from McLean High School, which is really being a great citizen. So I think installing value in my daughter and my son, for that matter, I think is
wonderful. What's the website address, Niels?
It is www.conservation.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Niels Krona, who is the COO of Conservation International. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and a chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs, and what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress, and one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners, who want to be better at what they do, and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at that. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gordon Bernhardt, with Bernhardt Wealth Management. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Andrew Watt, who's the president and CEO of an organization called the Association of Fundraising Professionals. What is the Association of Fundraising Professionals, Andrew?
Well, we're an association about achieving impact. Fundamentally, we're here to help nonprofit organizations and the people who work for them achieve impact through raising money.
When was the association started?
Slightly over 50 years ago now. We're the oldest association of its kind in the world.
And how big or small is it today?
We have 30,000 members in 27 different countries around the world, but predominantly in North America.
Yeah. So why even start an association like this 50 years ago? Why do you suppose it was necessary?
It was about facing a need, a real need, to bring the nonprofit community together to skill up, basically. There was a huge recognition of the need to fund nonprofit activity, but people didn't really understand how to do that. So a group of guys in New York got together, said, we'll start an association, great American tradition of nonprofit associations, and we'll use that to build professional skills.
You have an interesting take on what you call it uniquely in American, this need to do associations. Tell us about that.
I think the thing that strikes me as a foreigner working in the United States is that sense of community. Everything comes back to If you can't do it yourselves, if you can't do it together, then why would you want the federal government to come in? So you go back to the 1830s and Alexis de Tocqueville looking at American society and saying, association, free association, is one of the fundamental rights of this country. And that's true today. You undersell yourselves, but it's a uniquely U.S. thing.
And when did you become the president and CEO?
I took over as president and CEO at the beginning of last year, so I've been there for just over 12 months and with AFP since 2006.
And so you started in what capacity?
Started as vice president for international development. It was a job that was created for me by the then CEO. She brought me across from the UK, where I've been working for a similar body. And since then, I progressed through another job as well.
So this organization created a role just to get you in?
Absolutely.
Why?
I think that they saw they'd reached a watershed. They described themselves as an international organization. They had contacts around the world, but they weren't quite sure how that was relevant to their core membership in North America, and also what the value of AFP engaging with other organizations outside North America was. They felt they needed somebody like me to come in, and specifically me to come in, to help them achieve the cultural change internally, but also to understand much more effectively about where we would add value outside North America.
And you became the CEO about a year ago. Why were you the ideal pick?
I think any organization gets to a point where it has to go back to base. And I think that one of the things over 50 years we've moved away from was the world in which our members lived. And for me, coming from a strong nonprofit background, the types of organizations, the communities in which our members work, is paramount. I mean, that's what really defines who we are and what we can achieve. We'd got to the point where we saw ourselves as a professional society, as a trade association, and I think we distanced ourselves from the real impact that our members achieve on the ground.
And why did you want the job?
I wanted the job because I could achieve change. I'd spent my career growing up as a public policy development, that sort of side of things. I'd handled the operations piece. I put various pieces of the jigsaw together, but I'd never been in control of the jigsaw. And for me, I love being at the middle. I love helping other people maximize their benefit.
Andrew, you said that they created that position for you in 2006. Did you also know that in 2011 that you would be president and CEO? In other words, were they grooming you for this role?
No. In 2011, I went through the first formal hiring process of my career. Korn Ferry were retained to handle the whole process from start to finish, and we had nearly 400 applicants for the job. So that was a very different process. However, as the internal candidate, I knew I had nothing to lose. People thought they knew me, and I had to really convince them that they didn't.
But you said so this is the first time you've actually gone through an interview in your whole career?
Yes, I'm 49, and it's the first formal interview process that I've ever had to submit to.
What surprised you most when you took over the reins?
How much I enjoyed it.
Okay. What specifically? What makes this so much fun?
It's that ability to bring people together and help them get the best out of themselves for the organization. It's that ability to define the path. Bring people together to define the path of the organization and to help them understand what you could truly do if you work effectively at it.
So I notice you have a very interesting Brooklyn accent. What part of Brooklyn are you from?
Somewhere near Inverness.
Yeah.
Inverness, Brooklyn.
Where are you from?
I grew up in the UK. My family are predominantly Scottish, but like a lot of people in the UK, we've gone all over the world over the generations. So I'm a mutt. I'm a real 57 varieties.
So what was it like growing up?
It was great. I grew up in a rural part of the UK, but my dad was in the military. He was in the Navy, so we traveled a certain amount, lived in Italy. Moved around. My mom was the one who held the thing together.
Mm-hmm. How did that experience shape you?
I think it taught me to recognize the richness of cultural diversity. It taught me to understand that people are different, but that actually if you bring them together in the right way, they can achieve great things through that difference.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're 8, you're not thinking like that. But by the time I was 13 or 14, I began to understand what that was doing for me.
Mm-hmm. And you went to college and got a degree?
I got a degree.
What in?
In late medieval history.
And that was a good idea?
It was a great idea. I mean, I can give you the general liberal arts justification of analytical thinking, writing, all the rest of it. But the thing that's been more useful to me than anything else is my thesis on the development of late medieval papal taxation.
Oh, I'll have to read it sometime. when did you start getting the idea that you wanted to take the direction that you now are in?
Yeah, well, if anybody had said to me when I was at college that I'd be working for fundraisers for the rest of my life, I would have first said, what's a fundraiser? And then I'd have laughed. I think it took me a while. I began to learn my way around it through my volunteer activity more than my professional track.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Well, I worked for an organization in the UK that existed to help kids who'd fallen through the net, kids from 14 to 24. And I was working in a very unpopular field. Getting funding for it was incredibly challenging. You know, you're helping kids who'd been in juvenile detention or were in the prison system to negotiate probation services, welfare services, all of that, and trying to make sure that it was funded. And that's not easy.
But somewhere you got the idea you could have more impact raising the money. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. What it was, I recognized that people didn't understand what fundraising did to achieve impact through philanthropy. People didn't understand the leverage, if you like, that fundraising brings to the nonprofit world. And I didn't at that stage identify so closely with the cause that I wanted to go and fundraise for that. But I've always looked at the environment, the operating environment for nonprofits, and recognize that there's a huge piece of work there to just help them do what they do, but do it better.
So tell us about your career path then.
Sure. I started off as a consultant, as many of us do, working in Brussels representing the Institute of Fundraising in the UK. There were various pieces of regulation going through, data protection directive, cross-border giving, that kind of stuff. And I was just completely gripped by it. The only conscious career choice I made at that point was that I would not be a banker. I would not be a stockbroker. I wanted to work for nonprofits.
Any regrets looking back?
No. My wife might have some regrets, but not me.
What would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is?
I think it's working with a failing organization and turning it around. That's happened to me a couple of times in my career. And it's really helping people to retain the passion they feel for the cause and the organization, but recognize that they need to participate actively in a root and branch reform.
Well, how do you get somebody to buy in?
It's about the mission. It's about the impact. It's about trying to help people understand what the world would be like if that organization ceased to exist. It's the deficit argument, if you like.
Right. How did you make the transition from fundraiser to leader?
Fundraisers are leaders. Fundraisers are all about helping people achieve their dreams. And you know, so anyone who works in that field automatically has those skills that you need. But there's a big difference between being part of the team, then managing the team, and then becoming the leader of the team. I think you grow into it. I think you begin to realize that the important thing, the really important thing, is to understand yourself, to understand what strengths are that you have, that are unique to you, that you bring to the table, and how that helps everybody else come together. I think a true leader has to lead, but you also have to be a catalyst. You also have to be something that converts ideas and abilities into the end game.
How important is impact to you?
Critical. I mean, it really defines my career path. It defines why I chose to do the things I wanted to do. And to a degree, it defines me for myself.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
I think my proudest moment was the day I saw my first child, to be honest. But in a professional context, my proudest moment was sitting down at my first AFP board meeting. Not the first AFP board meeting I attended as a staff member, but my first as CEO. Because I could look around, and we're a volunteer-led organization. We have 400 volunteers, 30,000 members. And looking at that room and recognizing that they were all there to achieve, with me, with my team, the same end. I mean, that was a very proud moment.
Wonderful. What's the website address, Andrew?
www.afpnet.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Andrew Watt, who's the president and CEO of the Association of Fundraising Professionals. I'd like to thank my co-host, Gordon Bernhardt with Bernhardt Wealth Management, for helping me out. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host, and I'm joined by Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management as my co-host. Joining us for this interview is Steve Martin. Co-founder and managing partner of a company called Pace Harmon. What is Pace Harmon?
Pace Harmon is a management consulting firm that focuses on what we call outsourcing advisory, which means we help companies, Fortune 500 companies, assess whether they should be outsourcing business functions like information technology or finance and accounting, or whether, if they're in an outsourcing relationship, they should be thinking about repatriating or insourcing.
That's interesting, because up till now, I thought that was the trend. Everything should be outsourced. That's not true?
It's definitely not true. There are certain aspects, processes that are very strong candidates for outsourcing, particularly ones that are routinized, that are where processes are very clearly defined. The value is sort of on the lower end, and there's a cost structure, an opportunity to leverage a cost structure that can affect your P&L in a positive way, but it's certainly not for every business function and not for every company.
So what is lost potentially by outsourcing a function that shouldn't be outsourced?
You lose, it depends. It depends how you structure the agreement. You can lose institutional knowledge over time, so that sort of erodes and it becomes sort of in the domain of the outsourcer. You lose people, the people that develop the processes in the first place and all of the knowledge that goes along with that. You know, at times you actually lose control over the actual delivery of the service. So you have an IT service or finance and accounting or HR, and the quality that you may want to maintain actually gets compromised because it's not done the same way you would have done it inside. So it's definitely... It's not for the faint of heart, to say the least.
So the company was founded back in 2003. You're up around 65 consultants now, correct?
That's correct.
When did you realize you could make a business of this? When did it dawn on you that, wow, there's a business opportunity here?
We pretty much knew that when we opened our doors. So we started the company with nine consultants. We had a backbone client. We were profitable from day one. We put money in the company just to have it there, but we were profitable from day one. And then it was a matter of working through and figuring out where we wanted to focus. We didn't want to be sort of a microcosm of a Deloitte or a Booz Allen or a McKinsey. We wanted to basically define a space and be a dominant player in that space, and we've become that.
So why not just do this inside the company you were with?
It's a great question. The principal reason was, as a Big Four accounting firm, that was Deloitte, which is where we were, There were a number of services that the firm couldn't provide. So if you think about an accounting firm and they may have a test clients that include an IBM or an HP or a Wipro in India, whom they're auditing, they can't be sitting across the table negotiating a contract with that same company. There's a conflict of interest. So there was a compromise in the type of service that that company or PwC can actually offer, and it was something that we were able to do completely unencumbered. And that was a very important dimension of why we thought we could do this better outside of the firm.
Right. What was the biggest surprise when you started the firm?
Biggest surprise was that our backbone client was acquired by another client 9 months after we opened our doors. And as our backbone client and the place where most of our consultants were serving, we had to quickly figure out what next. And we were fortunate in that we were able to forge a relationship with a consulting firm that actually served the combined entity. And we literally missed a couple of beats, and we were back up and running. And it spoke very clearly to us that diversification was not only something that we knew we had to do, it was something we had to do fast, and that was kind of our focus for the next 3 years, to diversify our client base, which we were successful doing.
I mean, you make it sound so easy, and you weren't scared?
We were scared. The beauty of this business is that you can be successful with really smart people. So you need methodology, you need tools, you need a process. But at the end of the day, what companies are buying are individuals. They're not buying a firm. And we always say it's the name on the back of the jersey as opposed to the name on the front of the jersey. And in our firm, we spend more time looking at recruits and candidates and understanding, you know, how to get the A players to join our firm. And it's not just for the sake of doing it. It's for the sake of serving our clients. That's a very important dimension of what we offer. We're offering high-quality resources, not just sort of the name of the firm.
Yeah, so much has been written about top talent. How do you know top talent sitting in front of you?
It's tough. I mean, there are certain metrics that you can sort of dissect. So what schools did they go to? What were their GPAs? What were their SAT scores? What firms did they work for before they joined us? At the end of the day, we go through a series of interviews. We probably look at 200 resumes to phone screen 20 to interview in person 5 to make a single offer. So we go through a very rigorous process and with multiple people interviewing each candidate. And it's just it's a matter of really sifting through everything we can, case studies and analytical questions. And
but the GPA aside and the resume and all that, how do you know you're sitting across the table from one? Somebody you want to hire, you just know it?
I mean, you don't just know it. You have to. I mean, there's a certain instinct you have when somebody's talking with you, when you ask questions, they have a certain level of knowledge or experience or a certain swagger. But at the end of the day, it's you know, 3 yards in a cloud of dust every time. We're grinding it out with these people and testing every possible dimension because these are the people that we're putting in front of our clients.
Why would somebody go through all that rigor to work for you? What makes you such a great place to work for?
I think it's our culture. We have a very collegial culture. We have this motto in our firm that it's client first, firm second, individual third. It's kind of our credo, and the notion is if you take care of the first two, you automatically take care of the third. It's a collegial atmosphere. It's supportive. We send an email out with a request for information, and within 15 minutes, you'll have 15 responses back. I mean, there's just this sense and spirit of teamwork that makes this a really rich culture and something that we believe is a big selling point for us.
This culture that you've been so careful to create and keep, when did you realize that this kind of culture was the one that you had to have?
I think when we left Deloitte, a few people that left Deloitte had this in their DNA. In other words, the folks that we chose to leave with had this in their DNA. So it was almost like in a perverse use of the word, an inbred type of outcome. We knew that by starting the firm with people that had these principles, the collegiality, we knew that we would attract others with that same kind of DNA, and that was we knew it from the very start. We knew it was an important part of our ability to be successful, and it's proven to be the case.
Where are you from, Steve?
I'm from Washington, D.C.
What were Mom and Dad doing growing up?
Dad was a physicist, hydrodynamicist to be more specific. He was a person that designed submarines for a living. Mom was an English lit major who became a registered nurse. So I had the right side of the brain and left side of the brain working for me as I grew up.
Yeah. Talk about the influences of the right side and the left side. How did Dad shape you?
Good balance, first of all, in terms of the influences. I think that on the father's side, there was this kind of live by example. I mean, he was my hero in life, the smartest man I've ever known, strong work ethic, but didn't wear it on his sleeve. And I think that, you know, it was just sort of classic, you know, just watch me without saying it. And you sort of just learn from being in his presence. And you know, and he, you know, very strong influence in our education and discipline around studying and you know, with a heavier focus on the math and physics and engineering than on the English. But, you know, we got that side from our mother.
And how about Mom? What do you think you took from growing up with her?
I think she gave us our emotional IQ and kind of, you know, our ability to kind of, you know, interact. My dad was great in that context, but my mother was... You know, she was the more social of the two, and you know, just had this demeanor and this kind of charm about her that you know, I think we sort of learned, and it was just sort of effervescent. So.
Yeah, what would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is?
Wow, you know, I think it was probably starting this firm. I mean, we left with a backbone client. We had the situation that I mentioned about 9 months into it. Having the potential to close our doors, and we just grinded through it. We made a few calls, we had a few relationships that we pulled in, we kind of engineered an outcome, and we were able to not only save the firm, but basically create effectively the beginning of the firm. Yeah. So it was probably the toughest thing we ever came.
What did you discover about yourself through that incident?
Maintaining kind of a calm demeanor, being very disciplined, being very focused, being very analytical and kind of thinking through the various obstacles and recognizing that at the end of the day, you know, we all have other options, and you know, we had to kind of, you know, be very, very specific about the path we chose, but recognizing that, you know, we could fail a few times and not sort of, you know, suffer a demise. So we just kind of learned that you had to be very thoughtful and disciplined, right, about your approach.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
My son. I mean, I know that sounds a little bit simplistic, but I got married very late in life. 50 years spent single. My wife tells me that you know, she got the raw end of the deal. She gets the latter 50 years. I had the first 50 to myself. But I think you know, we had a son about 18 months ago, and it's the joy of our lives. Thanks.
Thanks. What's the website address?
PaceHarmon.com. That's PaceHarmon.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Steve Martin, who's the co-founder and managing partner of a company called Pace Harmon. I'd like to thank my co-host, Gordon Bernhardt. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Judy Marks, who's the president and CEO of Siemens Government Technologies, Niels Krona, who's the COO of Conservation International, Andrew Watt, the president and CEO of Association of Fundraising Professionals, and finally Steve Martin, the co-founding and managing partner of Pace Harmon. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Join IHEPA and NFL greats Brian Mitchell, Roy Jefferson, Brig Owens, and the voice of the Redskins, Larry Michael, for the IHEPA Metro Golf Classic, benefiting Fisher House on May 23rd at Westfields Golf Club in Clifton, Virginia. The incredible Dennis Walters Golf Show is also featured as part of this charity event. Register at ahepagolf.com. That's ahepagolf.com. And join IHEPA in support of a wonderful cause, the Fisher House.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions.